models that are around and how some of these models of awakening, they've almost come to distinguish different traditions of Buddhism, you know, like whether it's Mahayana or Theravada or Zen or Mahamudra, they've almost come to distinguish different traditions of Buddhism. But I think the reality is that all of these models are actually found in the early texts. You know, so Nibbana is not presented as kind of a one size fits all type of thing. It's considerably more nuanced than that in the early texts, and that's what I want to sort of draw on. So the first of the models that you actually see in the early texts is a kind of sudden breakthrough school. You know, the Buddha gives a talk and 500 people are arahants and are awakened, you know, and some talk, you know. It's also remembering that in the early, in Pali, the phrase, you know, 500 or the word 500, words 500, is used to mean a lot. Nobody did a kind of head count, you know. It's just used to mean a lot. But that's a very striking model in the early texts, you know, that there are these instances where the Buddha's teaching something and suddenly people really get it. You know, you have the story of Angulimala, you know, the serial killer, you know, who, you know, is out to get the Buddha, you know, and, you know, in the story, you know, he no matter how fast he runs, he doesn't catch up to the Buddha, and he shouts out to the Buddha, you know, stop, stop, why don't you stop? And the Buddha answers, you know, I have stopped, why don't you? It was a moment of awakening for Angulimala. You know, he stopped being a serial killer, he became an arahant. Still had to suffer the effects of his previous actions, by the way. So these models of kind of like sudden awakening are very, very present in the discourses. You know, if you look even at the legend of the Buddha, you know, he sat down under the Bodhi tree, unawakened, got up awakened. A transformation, you know, in a single night. It doesn't always completely take into account, you know, the many years of practice that had preceded, an understanding that had preceded the Bodhi tree. But the model of sudden awakening is really there. You see it in various traditions, you know, the aiming for this aha moment, you know, the epiphany moment, you know, and everything is sort of designed to pursue that. You very much see the model of the gradual path, you know, the development of ethics, the development of collectedness, the development of wisdom, in which the obscurations of mind, you know, of greed, hatred, and delusion are gradually becoming more transparent, you know, less credible, beginning to fall away. And in that, in the gradual path, very much there's emphasis upon cultivation. You know, the cultivation of ethics, the cultivation of a mind that is a friend, you know, the cultivation of the conditions, inner conditions, that are really conducive to understanding, a kind of gradual awakening. You see in the early discourses the presentation of the cessation of cessation. Now, there's two ways in which that's presented in the early discourses. Sometimes it's presented really in a kind of mode of concentration development, that the mind becomes so, so focused and so, so one-pointed that there ceases to be the arising of any kind of fabrications. You know, the mind comes to this place of absolute quietude. But in the early discourses, cessation is also presented, as I was speaking about this morning, the cessation of the leakages, you know, the cessation of leaking greed, hatred, and delusion, the cessation of fabricating a world, not just in meditative states, but in ordinary moment-to-moment experience. You know, in the Buddha put it, he says, on contact, the world of experience arises. And with the cessation of contact, there's the cessation of the world. And that's the world of fabrication, you know, the world of constructing our personal world of experience. In other traditions, you see Nibbana really being presented as being very much the sort of ground of being. You know, we hear state words like Buddha mind or essence, you know, or essential nature. And often what's being presented is that you know, that we're already awakened and we just don't know it, you know. And so somehow our practice is really just clearing away the obscuration, so the very natural radiance and clarity of the mind is revealed. Now, it can be very confusing when we hear these different models, and we need to be so careful here, because we might find ourselves drawn to one model and not another. You know, like, I really like the sound of I'm already awakened. You know. I mean, but we really need to be so careful that we're not drawn to a model because it supports our delusions, rather than it being a model of what actually would benefit us. So it's useful to hold these different models and to recognize that every single one of them is there in the early texts, except that we're already awakened. That one you don't actually find in the early texts. That is a kind of later presentation. But then you look at the different models and you say, well, what are the places of agreement? You know, what are the places where these different models actually concur? You know, and rather than getting caught in a particular view or a particular, that's what I should be going for, what are the basic places of agreement? Well, one of them is the end of dukkha. Another is the end of ignorance, of confusion. Another is actually the peaceful nature of awakening. You know, that is actually put down the argument. It's no longer in a state of contention. Another place of agreement is actually the dissolution of this centralized me. That is a very primary place of agreement. The dissolution of this centralized me, the I am. Another of the places of agreement is actually in the unshakable nature of those awakenings, that nirvana is not temporary, that it's not something, because it's an understanding rather than a state, that it's not temporary, that this is actually a realization that is actually steadfast and unshakable. As the Buddha once put it, he says, you know, wood can turn into ashes, but ashes don't turn back into wood. So the Buddha very much presents this as a developmental path in which there's we don't start with unshakable. You know, it's real though. We don't start with unshakable insights and unshakable understandings. We often start with understandings that can feel quite shaky and easily forgotten or easily obscured. But it's recognizing that, and it's having the kind of humility to recognize that. And yet it's the very commitment and the practicing that turns the shakable into the unshakable. And I think it is important to envisage that as a possibility. And you know what? I think we have evidence in our own experience to support it. You know, if you've been practicing for a while, it's quite likely that you have seen something fall away that actually you're not interested in entertaining its return. In the Satipatthana Sutta, which many of you will, of course, be familiar with, the ways of establishing mindfulness, it's really good to look at the last part, you know, the last piece in that discourse, that a person cultivating this path of insight could find complete liberation within 7 years, or even 7 months, or even 7 weeks, or even 7 days. It seems to suggest that once sati, once mindfulness is really established, every moment is pregnant with the potential to be awakened. Every moment is pregnant with that possibility of awakening in that moment. Now, it's curious because, you know, we bring our minds to this practice, you know, and we bring our histories and we bring our conditioning and, you know, all of the things, all the ways that we've been taught to approach life. This is, of course, totally normal and totally understandable, and it wouldn't be any different. But we do need to be careful of the mind that we actually bring to the path, because that actually really shapes how we're going to approach this path for ourselves. You know, there will be those who bring to this practice, you know, who really, you know, have, well, perhaps many of us have become accustomed to defining ourselves by experiences and events. You know, that I'm successful or a failure, you know, I'm an extrovert or an introvert, you know. We are prone to define ourselves by events and experiences and by the contents of our minds. And in that, you know, we might then want to make nibbana into an event that's going to deliver a better self-definition. You know, I'm going to be enlightened, you know, I'm going to be awakened, looks pretty good. But at the same time, I think as sort of collective human patterns, we, and perhaps even more pronounced in some cultures more than others, we bring into this practice, I think, often quite a burden of doubt, quite a burden of self-doubt and path doubt. You know, where we sort of feel hesitant about the idea of awakening, or we sort of feel like, you know, maybe it's just a story, or maybe it's just something from the past, or, you know, if we don't get immediate results, it's probably not going to be for us, you know, or, and, you know, so we kind of tend to steer away from the sort of patience needed in this development. I think the patience that is needed in this cultivation, you know. Progress. I hope that you see some progress in your path. And I know we sort of could have an allergy to that word, but I hope that you see some progress in your path. And I think anyone who's been practicing for a while sincerely will indeed see progress in their path. Have you found yourself, you know, less prone in some, less extreme in some areas of reactivity? Have you found yourself more sensitized to others and to your relationships with others? You know, have you found yourself less prone to sort of totally subscribe to every moment of identification? Have you found yourself more able to hold difficulties with some equanimity and with some spaciousness and some kindness? Have you found yourself more able to respond compassionately rather than with blame? You know, have you found yourself even more able to listen to some extreme political ideologies and not entirely want to shoot the person who's spouting them, you know? You know, there is progress that is measurable, that is possible, you know. I think it's so important, actually, that we notice this. That we notice this. You know, that we actually acknowledge this and value this. You know, perhaps we see the awakening of our own hearts. And there is no uniformity, I think, or even necessarily predictability in the process of awakening. You know, I think for many people, the path has a sort of cyclical nature. You know, that there can be moments of great clarity and suddenly a bout of depression, you know, or a doubt storm, you know, where we think all is lost. And yet somehow we're returning, there's kind of been seeds planted where we don't entirely, and we're not so prone to define ourselves by the contents of our minds. this is a big liberation. You know, this is actually is a big insight, not to totally define yourself by the contents of your mind. When the Buddha just tried to describe his awakening to the five ascetics he'd been practicing with, he spoke of having discovered complete freedom of heart and mind from the compulsions of craving. From the compulsions of craving. He said his life, his mind, was no longer governed by the compulsions of craving. And if you reflect back to this morning when I spoke about the origins of craving, you know, that his mind, his life was no longer governed by those distortions and their obvious manifestations in craving and aversion. He said he had awakened from the dream of ignorance. And he called that awakening, by understanding the origins of dukkha and his end, he called that freedom the taste of the Dharma. The taste of the Dharma. And the Buddha, in his own teaching, you know, he very much described himself as a healer. You know, he very much used that medical model, you know, of healing rather than saving or rescuing. And he uses this medical model all the time of really understanding the nature of the disease, the understanding of the origins of the disease, the understanding the prognosis, you know, that they're of the prognosis and the applied course of treatment. And I think that is really a useful model, actually, to use for ourselves. Because it's not just limited to meditation. It's actually really, it really includes, you know, it's much bigger than that. It includes how we move in the world, how we interface with each other, you know, how we occupy our place in life as human beings who are interconnected and who are interrelated. And this so much widens the field of our concern that we don't just practice for our own awakening. You know, we practice for those we love, we practice for those we struggle with, we practice for those we don't know, we practice actually in the service of healing the disease. So I want to go into this map of awakening that the Buddha, one of the most kind of, you know, probably best known maps of awakening that the Buddha spoke about. So first of all, he speaks about the four pillars of awakening, of ethics, of the collected mind, of wisdom, the three pillars, of dana, ethics, collected mind, and wisdom. Speaks about these as being the four pillars of path, that, and the perfection of these may actually describe the landscape of an awakened mind. So he went on to... sorry about this, I don't know what I'm doing. I think I'm breathing into the mic. I could stop breathing. So he went on to describe the development of these stages of awakening as being the path of the noble ones. So there's four. It's one of the shortest. So there's Sotapanna, the stream enterer. Sakadagami, the once returner. Anagami, the non-returner. And the Arhat, the fully awakened. Now, this is actually what I want to focus the rest of the weekend on, is the insights involved in these, because this is kind of like a map of awakening that is also, I have to say, can be a practice of awakening. So this map of awakening really describes stages of awakening rather than states of awakening. Now, these stages of awakening are really characterized by the insights that have come to fruition and by what has fallen away. And that is why these stages of awakening can be very much used as a roadmap of practice, not as a roadmap of evaluation of where you are or where you're not, but really as a roadmap of practice. What are the insights that are coming to fruition, and actually what is falling away. They're distinguished primarily by actually what is being relinquished. So there, I think this is a particular map of awakening that I find is really useful because it doesn't set up goals to strive for, but actually it really sets up a kind of template of development, a template of cultivation, which I have to say is really available and applicable, I think, to us all. So this is not about some sort of theoretical or abstract map. It's about something that we're encountering every moment of our lives, you know, some possibility in every moment of our lives to explore what we are contracting around. What is actually obstructing freedom? And what is actually providing freedom in any given moment? So this is not about what we're doing on a cushion, it's about what's going on in our mind, what's going on in how we're seeing, what's going on in how we're responding, what can be cultivated, and what can be relinquished. In a way, this is actually what is turning this unshakable liberation into a process of liberating. Liberating the moment, and learning to liberate these areas or these tendencies to contract around that which actually binds us. You know, so often when the Buddha speaks about liberation, he talks about this process of unbinding. I find that a really helpful word myself. I don't find letting go a helpful phrase at all. And actually, it's not really a good translation of any Pali word, actually. And it's so problematic, isn't it, letting go? I mean, have you tried it? Have you tried shouting at yourself to let go of things? Notice how spectacularly unsuccessful it usually is. You know, again, it comes back as if I've got some autonomous me that's going to let go. But the Buddha much more talks about unbinding through understanding. And we're unbinding that tendency to contract. We're unbinding from that tendency to be imprisoned by, to be identified with, to subscribe to. We're learning to unbind through understanding. So this map actually gives some pointers to what on a moment-to-moment level obstructs freedom and what brings freedom. This is a very present moment map. So before we get into this, has anybody got any questions? Pause a moment. Yeah, please. Generosity, integrity, collectedness, and insight. These are the sort of four pillars of awakening. I think as we understand that these are really very much practices in themselves, aren't they? I mean, generosity clearly is not just, it's not a monetary concern. You know, generosity is really the cultivation of fearlessness, isn't it? The cultivation of a mind that is not withholding, you know, of a mind that's not kind of living in that fear of insufficiency. Generosity is very much seen as being the appropriate response to greed and to craving. So, you know, that in itself is really a practice of insight. And certainly not just on a monetary level, but generosity with our time, our attention, our space, you know, our sensitivity, compassion, metta, you know, not treating these qualities as if they're kind of like limited reserve qualities, you know. So it's very much, generosity is very much a practice of fearlessness. Integrity is very much a practice of compassion and dignity and respect, you know, and it's very much a guardian of the mind. You know, the Buddha speaks about ethics as being a guardian of the mind and a guardian of the world. You know, it's really what begins to calm the sort of compulsions of greed and hatred and delusion. And actually, as often the Buddha speaks about, integrity as a first step of liberation, because this is actually what cultivates a mind that is free from residues. Free from residues. Collectedness is a big one because we need to learn how to attend. We need to learn how to be here. We need to learn how to be grounded where we are, to be paying attention to what's actually going on. And collectedness here is not concentration, by the way. It is a sense of unification of body, mind, and present moment. And, you know, the image that I often use of late is of, you know, the sheepdogs in Wales. You know, and, you know, in Wales, the sheep range over very broad hills and mountains and pastures, and they have these wonderful dogs that go to collect the sheep in. And they don't intimidate them, and they don't frighten them, and they don't bite them, they don't shout at them, but they know how to guide and collect the sheep and to move them from pastures that don't serve them well anymore into pastures where they will flourish. And that's what collectedness is about. We're actually gathering our attention from places that don't serve us well anymore. You know, the fantasies, the strategies, the endless narratives, you know, the daydreams, the wandering, the distractedness, you know, gathering our attention from places where it don't serve us well anymore and steering our attention into a more unified way of being present in the present moment, in the place where we can flourish. And then insight, and these are the four kind of pillars of awakening. What else has got anything? Okay. This Sotapanna, or the stream enter, is quite obviously one who has entered the stream. And the stream that the Sotapanna has entered is actually the stream of the Eightfold Path. So this again goes a little bit back, if we're mixing metaphors, a little bit back to the raft story. The Sotapanna has entered, this is actually, in all of these stages of awakening, the stream entry is actually the most significant. It is the one that actually really ensures that the stream that is entered has been fully entered. The stream enter is not one who's sitting on the edge of the Eightfold Path and wondering whether it's a good idea, you know, or what might be at risk, or, you know, maybe or maybe not, you know, or is anybody else doing it, you know, or, you know, filled with, you know, fear about what I'm going to lose or relinquish. The stream enter is one who's entered the stream of the Eightfold Path with a total confidence and in the stream of the Dharma or where it goes. I know that this is leading to liberation. The Sotapanna, the stream enterer, is free, liberated from the first three obstructions that bind us to distress. The first of those is personality view. The second of those is skeptical doubt. And the third of these is the attachment to rites and rituals. Rites and rituals. These are the three primary obscurations that stream entry is free from. Through understanding, not through, you know, some other mechanism, but through understanding. One on the path of stream entry knows that these are the places, the most obvious places, that cause suffering and struggle and are most contracted around. So these are the three I'd like to spend a little bit of time with. How are you doing? You know, restless, agitated, aversive, you know, any of those things, sleepy. What I'm asking, is it time for a walking period before we get into this very big piece of teaching? I think it might be a good idea, okay? So then we'll come back. So that's the cliffhanger.